This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fish and Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend. And today we've got a special guest for you. We've actually been chatting a little bit, getting to know him. So I'm excited to have a good conversation. But first up, we'll go ahead and get our intros out of the way. So quick update on what's going on in my world. Looking that antelope season for archery just opened here quickly, just a few days ago. So I will be full force into that coming this weekend. And, then the seasons roll. I was just talking with Alan, telling him I'm trying to get my feet under me as far as my plans for foraging and getting out and trying to find some wild edibles out and about as I'm going. So going to mash that together with my hunting aspirations as well, not to add any more complexity to it, but, you know, it is what it is. So outside of that, we completed our first class of our Harvesting Nature Supper Club, which is our online cooking classes. So we did that just yesterday. Or no, sorry, 2 days ago, 3 days ago. It doesn't matter for you because you're listening in podcast time, which is skewed from reality, but still very important. I taught a class making venison steak marsala, had a few participants. So that class is live on our website. You can go and purchase it for on demand if you want to go through that recipe and learn with me as I go through that. We have an exciting lineup from our other wild game chefs that will be running through different recipes this month, and we'll extend that into next month for sure. I think our plan is to keep rolling with it. Next month we may offer some butchering courses, some other recipes, some breakdowns, things like that. So stick with us on that, and please make sure that you're following that. Look for the details on the website. That's all under the Harvesting Nature Supper Club. It'll be under the Cooking Classes tab. Outside of that, we've got some updates for the Antler and Fin podcast, which is like your virtual recipe venue. So we basically take you through some of our top recipes step by step, item by item, line by line, all in a virtual podcast manner. So you can hit pause and play as you go through each step, narrated by yours truly.
It's like audiobooks for recipes.
Yeah, it's an audio cookbook. Is exactly what it is. And then, as always, you can buy us coffee if you'd like. Help keep us fueled on those late nights of podcast editing, recipe writing, and adventure planning. Those are always great to see pop in. I think we just had one a couple days ago where somebody bought us one $3 cup of coffee, which is great. Everything helps. And aside from that, I think, Corey, what updates you got for us?
Been getting ready for the archery season here in Pennsylvania. Some moving stands, scouting, but it's getting to that time frame where I'm trying to stay out of the spots where I want to hunt, so I'm not disturbing the deer. So now shooting the bow, shooting the broadheads, making sure everything flies right. So just getting all prepped for the season.
Nice. And when's your season first kick off?
Archery season opens the first Saturday in October, but our small game season starts in mid-September. So I use that time to take out the kids and shoot some squirrels and have fun in the woods.
Nice. And what do you got going on over at the Ventures for Food podcast?
We're always looking for new stories, new storytellers to tell their hunting and fishing stories. Every hunter and angler has a story to tell. And if you have a good one, we want to hear from you. So email us at whatscooking@harvestingnature.com or shoot us a DM on Instagram or something. Get a hold of us and we'll get you recorded and on the show.
Yeah, we absolutely love to hear the stories. I actually recently just recorded one. So it was, I think the title is Bulls, Sharks, and Lions, Oh My. And it's a recount of my last trip down in the Florida Keys spearfishing for lionfish, which we then took up to the BHA dinner and cooked up. So some interesting encounters in that adventure. So definitely tune into that. But also, too, I want to give a shout-out to Allen Company. As always, we partnered with them for a number of years, so you can go over to them, buyallen.com, and use their coupon code HARVEST10 for 10% off your order at checkout. But, Corey, if you don't have anything else, I think I'm ready to introduce our guest.
Do it.
All right. So our guest today started his culinary journey with mushrooms and has since blossomed into a career that went through many kitchens, restaurant, and leading him to become the Forager Chef. On his website, foragerchef.com, you can find anything from seasonal cooking to restaurant dishes, home-style meals, nose-to-tail cooking, and so much more. He currently has the Forager Chef's Book of Flora Recipes and Techniques for Edible Plants from Garden, Field, and Forest. That book's available on Amazon. But I would like to welcome Allen Burgo to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Excited, you know, in the first few moments before we hit the record button, we got to chat a little bit and get to know you. But definitely want to dig into what you're doing and learn more about everything you're involved in. So first off, for our listeners out there, can you kind of tell us where you're from and your introduction to the outdoors?
So I'm from Minnesota. I was born in Wisconsin. I grew up in Minnesota, and I never really spent a lot of time outside. I lived on a farm, but I'd probably rather be inside or doing something with my friends. My introduction to the outside came when I was working in restaurants. So I started cooking when I was like 15 or 16, and when I went to college up in the Twin Cities, I had always been cooking as kind of my side gig, as just, you know, that was my job, how I made money. Eventually, I graduated from college and figured out I didn't want to sit in an office, but I was at restaurants, and I started at, you know, crummy fast food restaurants, and I worked up into the best places I could possibly find, and just, you know, it takes a long time. Eventually, I got to places that were working with local food, and one of the places in particular is called Heartland. We only worked with ingredients from within 200 miles of Minnesota.
Oh, wow.
And that meant no olive oil, no citrus, you know, no Italian Parmesan, nothing like that. So we worked with a lot of wild ingredients. During the season, people would bring stuff in, and I basically got spoon-fed, like, what all the best, the creme de la creme of everything in Minnesota and the Midwest was. I just got it brought to me. So before I went outside, I loved to play disc golf. And before I went out and started finding mushrooms playing disc golf, I already knew exactly what I was looking for. I'd tasted it, cooked it, been shown, trained how to work with these things in the kitchen. So the first thing I ever found was a chicken of the woods. And I just cleaned one the day beforehand in the kitchen, and I was out playing disc golf, and I saw one on a tree, and I said, the light went off, and I was like, okay, that is it. This is not some crazy, unattainable thing. And I brought it home and ate it because I knew exactly what it was already. So I was kind of lucky because I got to do speed learning and speed culinary training on the job with wild food. And from there, at the place I was working at, I got to write the menu every single day for the restaurant. It was kind of a unique concept. So whatever my station was, we would write the menu new every single day. So I started going out before work and trying to find things that I could put on the menu, because, as you know, kitchens are super competitive, and I wanted to be the best on the line. I wanted to be the best in the whole restaurant. So that meant I needed to learn more. So then I started buying all the literature I could and teaching myself more and more things. And first it was only mushrooms, because they were the most expensive things we would buy. Sure. And then, you know, sometimes you go out and you don't find mushrooms. So I said, okay, what do I have to do to never go home empty-handed? So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's a good strategy. I guess, so the majority of my culinary experience either comes from down south, New Orleans, or you know, on the West Coast, or down in the Keys. And I never had anyone calling, offering any sort of, well, you would get like maybe people grew fruit or brought fruit into you or something like that. But all the wild food, as far as like seafood or things like that, sort of had its own system. But what does it look like to someone who's bringing in mushrooms to a restaurant? Like, I haven't personally experienced that. I've heard it. You're not the first person I've heard it from, of somebody be like, oh yeah, we brought in some, you know, so-and-so, my mushroom guy brought in a couple, 3, 4, 5 pounds of whatever type of mushrooms. But how does that interaction generally play out?
I mean, there's a number of different ways. It's really like finding a farmer that grows really good vegetables. To find a good purveyor of wild food, you have to have some contacts. You got to know some people, and sometimes those people, it's different than going to like a farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys that I knew the best, his name was Leon. He was a retired guy. No one's really going to get rich. You're not going to get rich selling mushrooms unless you're like cultivating them and selling a ton.
Sure.
Like, sometimes people go out and they find a couple mushrooms. They're like, oh, I'm going to be rich. And then you'll be lucky to fill your gas tank. But this guy's name was Leon. Leon was retired, and he bought himself a plane, and he flew across the United States, went to different woods he knew, and then would harvest the mushrooms, bring them back to Minnesota, and sell them to whatever restaurant I was at the time. So he was a good guy. Until he sold us a batch of bitter boletes, and then we didn't buy from anymore. Then there's all kinds of people that will harvest different things throughout the season. Most of the time, people will cold call you, and they might show up at the door. They might show up in a van, you know, like they haven't bathed in a couple days and have some really, really nice mushrooms.
would you have somebody calling? It's like, hey man, I got some mushrooms I want to sell you. Like, the first thing that comes into mind is just like somebody rolling through the back alley in like a blacked out panel van, and just like opens up the back door, and it's just like boxes and boxes of mushrooms. And they're like, yeah, you got to check these out. These are the top line.
And sometimes it's like that. More often than not, it's just a person who got a nice haul. There are some, you know, when you find a good one, you try to keep them and treat them really well. Like, I have a lady from the Ukraine. The Eastern Europeans, they're like mushroom crazy.
Oh, yeah.
It is in their blood. They love mushrooms. They crave them. And they're really good at finding them. So Olina is her name, and she was super talented. She would bring me chanterelles. She'd bring, you know, 20 pounds of chanterelles at a time, or porcinis, or whatever it was, and they're all just meticulously cleaned and packed in between layers of fern leaves to keep them fresh. Yeah, and then I knew another guy just from Russia, Konstantin. He was really sloppy, but he could pick different mushrooms. Like, he was comfortable with different species from different areas he was at. So, you know, you buy from whoever will bring you a nice haul at a reasonable price.
You're going to have to explain what happened to Leon a little bit better. You threw out a type of mushroom that I'm not familiar with. So can you expand on that a little bit?
Okay, so porcini, basically, Leon brought us a bunch of bitter boletes. And a porcini is a bolete. A bolete is a mushroom that has pores underneath the cap instead of gills. Mm-hmm. And they're also known as the fleshy pored mushrooms. And there's a whole bunch of different really, really good species here in North America and around the world. The porcini are just one of many, many, many different kinds that you could pick. A lookalike of the porcini, it is, some of them are very, very bitter, and it would probably be a different, it's a different kind of group underneath, inside of Bilitis. You have Telopolis, Luxinum, Bilitis, and Suillus. And Telopolis are known for being very, very bitter. So it is an amateur mistake to bring bitter bolets to a chef, because you can taste a bolete and just spit it out and see, oh, this tastes good or this tastes bitter. And if it tastes bitter, you don't harvest them. You throw them back in the woods. So it's really an amateur mistake, but they also taste awful. And if you, say, put them in like a 10-gallon batch of tomato sauce, you'd have to chuck the whole shebang. So it's really just it's an amateur mistake as being careless, and yeah, you don't want to do business with somebody like that.
Oh, that's fair.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I could see it. I had the same question, Corey. So thanks for asking.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We've kind of laid the foundation as far as how you got your start foraging wild edibles. But I guess when you look at wild edibles and you look at from a restaurant, from a culinary standpoint, like, what do you think the scope, are people excited by more exotic edibles or I guess less seen in restaurants? Like, did people specifically come to your places of work to try the things, the very unique things you were putting forth, or do you think people recognized it on the menu or didn't?
So that's a good question, and it's a kind of a mixed bag. So on one hand, people will go weed their gardens and they will throw away purslane and lamb's quarter and nettles. On the other hand, when I would be doing the purchasing at one of the places that I worked at, or myself as the chef, I will pay more for nettles or purslane or lamb's quarter than I would for the best type of heirloom lettuce per pound. These are luxury goods, and you'll absolutely pay anywhere from $10 to $15 a pound for any of those plants that I mentioned.
Wow.
If you put them, a good example is milkweed. So if you put milkweed on a menu, some people might say, oh, it's milkweed. Oh, and it's poisonous. Oh, but it's also anything with the name weed in it. The people I have found, it helps to use a little bit of a creative license. So milkweed pods, I don't call them milkweed pods in a menu. I just call them wild okra. And then when someone asks, then I tell them, I would come out to the dining room, to the table, and explain to them that they were eating milkweed pods. Or I'd have the servers explain it to them. And, you know, when you phrase something just a little bit differently, or you're playful with something a little bit on the menu, if you want to frame something as a luxury good, like wild plants, they were brought to me. I learned them as a luxury good. When the Swedish ambassador came and I cooked for him, he requested nettles on the menu because it's a Scandinavian tradition. You know, they make nasal sopa. So I only knew of wild plants as a luxury good, and I wanted to show the populace, I wanted to show, you know, average diners, any diner, that wild greens are a luxury good. This is something delicious. It's growing right outside. You can come to this restaurant and I will charge you a bunch of money for it, but you can also go outside and get it yourself, you know?
That's awesome. I think that, yeah. That's cool because it definitely brings about a connection that people, you know, they may stroll into the restaurant with whatever premonitions they may have and then get excited by something on the menu, and it kind of leads them down this path to sort of explore wild edibles on their own, which is great.
Yeah, and I mean, like, as a chef, working with ingredients that I had never worked before, it's like catnip, you know? Mm-hmm. That's all a chef wants to do. All you want to do is cook with new, fun things.
Yeah.
It, you know, I started learning about wild edibles about, I don't know, 10 years into my culinary career. And I already knew how to cook most things. I can cook a steak to temp. I can cook 50 steaks to temp, cooking them at the same time. I can do the same thing with salads and, you know, and just about every darn thing you can throw at me. I work the pastry station, whatever. I do the butchery program. I've never cooked a nettle. You know, so it's exciting, and I think if you frame things in an exciting and an exciting way to people, people will take it as that. It's all about what the chef is excited about. So if you're excited about eating weeds and funky, cool, wild mushrooms, so will the diners. Diners will be too.
When it adds, you know, and I think that most chefs get excited when you start connecting food to stories, and you're able to go beyond the plate to sort of tell the adventure, you know? And I think that wild edibles lend to that very, very well, which is so cool to me. I wish in my culinary career I'd grown more close or had the opportunity to seek it out. So it's pretty awesome. So do you also hunt and fish? I know we touched on it a little bit, in addition to your foraging, or are they simultaneous?
So hunting and fishing is, I mean, you gotta think, okay, first and foremost, I'm a chef. You know, I spent 15 years behind the stove almost like every single working day of the week. And the shifts are really long, and they are not kind to your social life. Or having other hobbies that are not, you know, drinking after work or hanging out with other employees or going home and reading cookbooks and writing about what I was doing like I was doing. So hunting and fishing, I have big game hunters in my family that mm-hmm. I'm now getting to connect with, but I it's a skill that I never honed through most of my young life. I'm a terrible shot with a gun, but what I excel at and what my, I have a lot of friends who are hunters, and I'll go with them sometimes. I'll hunt rabbits, I'll hunt squirrels, mostly small game, the pigeons, the woodcock, peacock. I like different funky things. I'm the butcher. So mm-hmm. I was trained as a butcher in most of my restaurants. We just use whole animals. The restaurants I was trained in is whole animals. So I worked in the butchery program too. I also specialize in offal. You know, cooking with organ meats. So my friends that I have are very talented at bringing down animals, at whatever it may be at the moment. And then my favorite part is cutting them up. There's just about nothing I like more than stringing something up on a gamble and seeing how fast I can skin a deer, and seeing that is where the creative process for me really comes about is when I am taking the knife to the carcass and seeing what is the different cut I want to work on this year. What do I want to do this year that I haven't done before? Is there a different way that people cut an animal around mm-hmm. the world that I haven't tried? Or is there a new creative way that I can work with a cut that I've worked with before and do something new with it? So, I mean, last year I really wanted to focus on different parts of venison. So I tried to master cooking venison trotters.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That was a lot of fun.
All right, so now since you opened that, what's your experience with venison trotters?
Oh, they're excellent. So you have to – I have a video of it online, and I leave the hooves on.
Okay.
So I was inspired by my friend. Her name's Linda Black Elk. She's a Native American ethnobotanist on the Standing Rock Reservation in South Dakota.
Yeah.
And they harvest buffalo, and one of the things they make is a soup made of a scrubbed and cleaned hoof of a buffalo.
Okay.
It's like the thing is like this big.
Yeah,
right?
It's large.
And they cook the sucker in a crock pot until it's like falling apart. And then The crazy part is after that thing's fallen apart, they take a spoon and they will hollow out the inside of the hoof.
Okay.
And that is part of what goes into the soup. So it is like, you think about bone broth. It's like, this is like bone broth on steroids.
Oh man, I imagine it's like, and so I had, and gelatinous I, and oh, delicious.
Yes. It's sticky, icky goodness. But I didn't have a buffalo, so I thought, okay, I know I'm going to have like 50 deer feet this year, so I could probably do something with them. Just because I'll be cutting them up for my friends.
Yeah.
So I started saving them and playing around with them. So what I do is I cut them off at the kind of at the knee joint, and then I'll peel them, and it takes a little time, and then I just kind of trim around the hoof and cut into the soft part of the hoof so there's no fur, and then I clean them really well. You know, I give them a scrub, and I clean them with warm water too, because it helps release anything that's on there, mm-hmm. and then I'll cook them. Then I'll cook them in a crock pot. I'll cut them with a saw down into manageable pieces so they'll fit into something because they're a little bit long. Okay. And after that, it looks like you put the deer trotters into a pot and it looks like there is nothing on them. And then you cook it 2 hours later. It's like, oh my God, where did all this meat come from? And I will clarify here, it is somewhere in between in a land of meat and collagen, but uh-huh. it is good. So my Lakota friends would probably just put the whole like kind of like stringy thing into the soup. I chop it up, I mince it,
okay,
and
yeah.
I do all kinds of stuff with it. So I'll take it. You can make like head cheese with shank,
oh, wow.
with, like smoked shank meat. Oh you reduce that broth down, and it's like a Super Bowl, but it, like
really?
A really, but like a really good one. Oh yeah, like I said, I got the whole video that kind of illustrates that. But my favorite part was, you take a spoon and you go inside the deer hoof, and there is a nugget of meat behind this little bone. Also, the deer feet bones make great dice after you bleach them. And there is a nugget of meat that is like this succulent little morsel that's like half meat and half fat inside of like the toenail. And it's one of the best parts of meat that I've had on a deer, I tell you what.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm going to have to try this.
That's pretty cool.
It's so unique. I don't think I've ever heard of it, and I would bargain to say that if a person wanted to prepare this dish, that you could probably wander around your friends' houses as they process deer and be like, "I'll take those deer hooves right there. Don't toss them to the dog. I'll take them," and
just smile as they laugh at you.
Yeah, right. Don't pass judgment on me for my deer hoof affinity. Corey, what do you think? I don't know. You get a lot of deer up there in Pennsylvania.
That's definitely interesting. I'm not sure I'm brave enough to try it.
I think you could do it. We'll for anybody interested, we'll post the link to that video in our show notes. That way you can click on that and see Alan's method. I'm curious to. I'm gonna have to go research. I'm excited about this because why not?
Could you do it with an antelope? Since it's your antelope season?
All I did was take old French recipes for pig feet and just apply, or sheep feet, and apply it to deer. And one of the coolest things is I take all the meat and the collagen and mince it. Mm-hmm. You put it into a little tray and chill it, and it turns rock hard. You cut it into cubes. You bread it in flour, egg, breadcrumbs, and then you deep fry it, and it's like a gooey venison tater tot.
Wow, that blows my mind.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It's,
I don't know,
it's
I'm
called
thinking
a chromesqui.
Nice. I love how the old French recipes translate so well over into wild game. Like it's you know, part of it is that's what they were working with there, but also too, it's they work with the odd bits that a lot of people weren't working with at the time. So, yeah, I'm thinking about elk too. Now that it's on, you talk about like the buffalo, and I'm like, next step down from buffalo is elk. I mean, why not? Who's gonna keep the elk trotters? This guy. So, I don't know, Corey. It's your favorite question. If you want to ask Alan.
Yes, I like to ask everybody what they have in their freezer at the moment. So, what's in your fridge or freezer that you've foraged or hunted or fished for?
Oh, that's a good question, because I just moved everything I had kind of from my girlfriend. I had my stuff in my girlfriend's freezer, stuff in my apartment freezer, and now it's all in the mothership. So I just had a 40 cubic foot commercial freezer brought to my garage that I'm rigging up my garage. I just had the floor sealed with epoxy as a commercial kitchen. So yeah, it's got the heated floors and all that stuff. But in that freezer, I don't exactly know what's in like the house freezer. It's so small. I'm like, ugh, I could never even use this regular fridge. It's like, it's useless. I can't even do anything with this. There's a couple fun things in there, but I'll tell you that the only thing I put in my freezer so far right now is 2 days ago, I harvested 50 pounds of huitlacoche. So I just froze all that on trays, and then I vacuum sealed it all. And that's the only thing that is in my freezer right now.
Oh, nice. It's a big, you got a lot of space. You're going to have a busy season.
Yeah. No, I was at my friend's farm by Milwaukee, and he is the only person I know who's commercially growing huitlacoche. So we harvested about 700 ears, and every single ear is sold, and he is sold out for the next 2 years as it stands. Wow. And for those people who don't know, huitlacoche is Aztec for corn smut.
That's what, yeah. I think that was a question both Corey and I were going to get into. What exactly is it?
I have it in the notes for later on in the show, but since we're already talking about it. So that's corn smut. And my friend actually just sent me a picture. He's grown some corn in his garden, and he asked me if I wanted it. And I don't know what to do with it, but what is it? Where do you find it? And what do you do with it?
Well, so this is a Latin American tradition. Like the Aztecs, they would injure their corn and make it come because they liked it so much. So it's a mushroom that grows on corn. And it's when corn gets, how do you find it? It is, you're looking for areas, just like with a lot of the wild plants and things like that, not necessarily mushrooms. Sometimes mushrooms, if they're like wood decomposing saprobes or parasites or something, like if a tree gets injured, you can get a chicken of the woods. Like if it gets cut or if there's really strong hail. With corn, it's the same thing. So my dad's a corn and soybean farmer, and when he has a hailstorm or when the deer come to nibble on the cobs or when there's a flood, all of those sorts of disturbances will injure the corn and make them susceptible to Utzelagomatis, which is the corn smut fungus. And it'll get in there, and each kernel turns into like a gigantic kernel that kind of tastes like mushroom. And it is some weird, funky stuff. And most people, when they think of corn smut, they think of like some kind of like black, gooey, like awful looking stuff. And that's not it. Like, if you look at a rotten potato, those look like shit too. You know, you're not going to eat that. So it's you have to find it when it is nice and plump and preferably gray. But that being said, when the kernels are nice and gray and firm, they're edible. But they are also edible when they are slimy and black. And people in Latin America will harvest them like that. It's actually, it's not, there's an analogy in mushroom world, as my world kind of is, shaggy mane mushrooms, they will turn black and kind of get inky, and that is not a, basically, it's not a statement about their edibility. They're still edible. That blackening and turning to inky muck is a, it's an enzymatic process as opposed to bacterial decomposition. So it's, you heat it and cook it, and you can eat it. So like people in Latin America, they might take a matate, which is like a big stone, like rolling pin, and they'll take the gooey huitlacoche, the good, like firm huitlacoche, some stuff in between, a couple wet kernels, and they'll mash it all to a black paste. And then they cook that with a bunch of onions and garlic and tomatoes and cook it all down until it's nice and thick. And then you eat it as a meat substitute with warm tortillas. And it's really good.
Oh, wow. It does sound good. And I would imagine that once you mix it all together that you're going to lose that, the kind of ooey gooey sliminess that you would think of, but it's just the initial thought.
Yeah, so that's what's in my fridge. freezer, rather. 50 pounds of corn smut.
Definitely doesn't look very appetizing.
I guess the real question is, Corey, are you going to get it? Are you going to get it from your friend?
Well, I think it was only one ear, so I don't know. What can you do with one ear of corn smut?
Not too much.
Appetizers.
There you go.
Well, so as we look at that, and this is a good transition point. We're kind of at the end of summer now. What are things that we should be foraging for? What are things that we should be looking for? Or what are you foraging for as well?
Yeah. Okay. So end of summer. This is a really cool time. In the middle of summer, at least where I am up here in the Midwest, it's going to be really hot, right? So What happens when it gets hot? Most of the wild, like green leafy plants, those plants have been gone since May. So they've all gone to seed. The nettles have all gone to seed. The sochan, the watercress, cow parsnip, Virginia waterleaf, all of that stuff is all gone to seed. Once the heat of summer dies, it's like immediately, like somebody turns on a light switch. Once the heat of summer breaks and you start getting some cool nights, the wild greens come back. And a lot of times they're going to come back with like a slightly different looking morphology, like the way that they look, the shape. Or like sochan is a Rudbeckia cinereata. It's related to black-eyed Susan, and it's one of the traditional green harvested by the Cherokee in the American South. So it's a great plant to grow in the garden, really easy plant to grow, and most of the leaves are going to be growing on the flower stalk, kind of as the plant grows up, and it looks like kind of little sunflowers.
Okay.
In once the heat of summer dies, it makes gigantic leaves out of the base. They're called basil leaves. And those are the best leaves of the whole year. So you're also going to get brand new nettles, brand new watercress, brand new lamb's quarter, which you can also get if you mow it down. You'll keep forcing new growth. But you're going to get new tender young growth of all kinds of different leafy greens. But what I'm really looking for in the fall is I'm checking for nuts. I'm going to see what kind of nuts I'm going to get this year, because all the nut trees that I kind of focus on, like shagbark hickories, black walnuts, and butternuts, and acorns, their masting cycles may or may not overlap. So, for example, last year was kind of a bad year for black walnuts because we had this really bad cold snap in the spring, and I think it kind of messed up the pollination cycle or something, so there's not a lot of black walnuts, which is important for me because I may harvest 400 pounds of them a year because I work with a distillery to make we make about 1,000 bottles of liqueurs flavored with herbs and things that I pick every year, and we ship it across the country. So I harvested at least 400 pounds of unripe black walnuts this year. So the masting cycle is like actually important for me at multiple different times in the year. So last year was an okay year for black walnuts. This year was a great year for black walnuts. This year, also, I have not seen butternuts for the last 2 years, and now, finally, my butternut trees are masting, so I'm going to get a crop of butternuts this year. Hopefully, last year was an off year for shagbark hickories, so I'll also be going, when my friends are going to scout for deer season, I am probably going to, with my binoculars, to look up in the trees and see how many shagbark hickory nuts I can see on a branch, and then see, okay, can I get 30 gallons of nuts from a single tree? Is it going to be a light year? And then I'm planning on my nut harvest. And also that fall is when the mushrooms are bumping. So I'm going to all my mushroom spots too.
We have a lot of, I have a lot of shagbark hickories here, and I look for them because if you find a shagbark hickory, you find squirrels, and I like to go squirrel hunting, but.
Oh, absolutely.
What are you doing with the shagbark hickory nuts?
So with the shagbarks, this is pretty cool. I have a cracker for them that, the cracker I talked about with the black walnuts and the butternuts, yeah. That one will work with shagbarks, but I don't like cracking and picking nuts out of shagbark hickories at all. I don't like it at all. I think butternuts and black walnuts are a lot easier. What I do is I do the Native American technique, and there's actually a method, a walkthrough of how to do this in the book, and it's a Native American technique. You take the nuts, you crack them, you know, after they're cured and dried, and you pick them and pick the holes off and everything. You take the nuts, crack them to make sure that you don't have a single stale nut in there, because one stale nut can mess up the whole thing, And then traditionally they would put them in something called a butagan, which is basically a hollowed out tree trunk, typically made from a type of birch. And because the birch won't split, maybe they might use slippery elm too, I don't know. And then it's kind of hollowed out from burning with embers, so it's like a big mortar and pestle. And then you use a pestle that's the size of a boat oar, and you bash the nuts into a paste with the shell and the meat all together, and then you end up with this kind of sticky paste of nuts and shell that you can make into a ball. And people give these balls as a gift. And you take that ball of nut paste with shells in it, you put it in a bunch of water, and then you bring it to a simmer. You stir it for about 30 minutes, and then you stop stirring it. You turn the heat off, and you wait like 30 seconds. And then so all the shells have a heavier weight than the nut meats, so they all sink. And then you ladle off the fresh nut milk, and you season it with maple syrup and a pinch of cinnamon. And that's like the original nut milk that tastes like concentrated hickory, pecan. There's nothing like it.
When
they're fresh
awesome.
Cracked. Oh, it's so good. And you can cook stuff in it. You can cook rice in it. You can make sauces out of it. I make desserts out of it, like a hickory nut rice pudding based on this Native American technique called kanuchi.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ridiculous. It's like the strongest pecan. If you like pecans, it's like pecan crack. There's nothing like it.
I do. Oh, man. We do, you know, we have one of those contraptions that you make the nut milk with. You put the water and you put the nuts in there, and it kind of does some whizzing and blending, and you end up with nut milk. But we've been using a lot of pecan milk lately. And, man, I would not necessarily – I would prefer to try it kind of the – not as much the traditional way, but in a way similar to that and simmer it. And
excited. Simmer it. It'll be good.
Yeah. Ooh, that sounds good too. Cause I like growing up as a kid, we would make oftentimes for like breakfast, you'd take milk and put in rice with cinnamon and sugar, and that was kind of like you ate that as you would kind of like a porridge. And to me, that almost like what do you call it? It's like a drink you get in Latin American restaurants, like taco shops. Oh, my mind is blanking. With the cinnamon and rice milk.
Yeah, I'm drawing a blank. Horchata?
Yeah, horchata. There you go. It's like horchata, so that reminds me of that. But I'm now picturing a more like hickory, pecan-y like version of horchata that I would be drinking, which sounds magical.
Yeah, another really cool one that we'll be looking for in the fall is I go with my buddy Sam Thayer. And Sam Thayer is kind of like my mentor, and he's mm-hmm. probably the greatest forager in North America. He lives about an hour away from me in Wisconsin. And we actually go and we harvest. I live at the tip top, kind of right outside the top range of shagbark hickories. But what we do have is bitternut hickory. And bitternut hickory, most of my forester friends are like, do you like that tree? That tree is garbage. And it kind of is. But it actually isn't. So Sam and I will go out and harvest as many bitternut hickory nuts as we can. And the nuts are bitter. They're bitter. They taste terrible. But they have a thin shell. So okay. Remember talking about the Native Americans bashing up all those the shagbark hickories.
Yeah.
They used to do the same thing with the bitternut hickories, and they'd boil them in water, and then they'd see that when they boil them, a layer of oil would come to the top. And this is like a 2,000-year-old process. And the tannins that make the nuts bitter are not fat soluble. So it would be a non-animal fat source from boiled smashed nuts. So what Sam does is Sam puts them through a super expensive olive oil press, and he actually presses a commercial oil from them out of bitternut hickories that tastes like pecans that you can buy on his website, foragersharvest.com, and it's super cool. He does the same thing with acorns, and acorns kind of taste like hazelnuts. It's really just incredible. I mean, he paid somebody to harvest half a ton of black oak acorns, which are like this big, last year.
Oh, wow.
It's tiny. Yeah. Half a ton of acorns.
That's a huge amount.
This is a huge amount. And then he cracks them in this rotary cracker, and he puts them through an olive oil press, and he sells that oil online. It's incredible. I'll help him harvest nuts. My girlfriend's farm that I live on has a lot of bitternut hickories, so we'll do that too.
So I was going to ask, you mentioned before the tannins that make the bitter nuts bitter. Are they similar in the tannins that in acorns as well? Because I know as you're processing acorns, there's a process to remove those tannins from the acorns. So same?
As far as culinary purposes are concerned, they are the same.
Yeah. But yeah, okay.
And like I would assume you could leach bitternuts too, but I wouldn't even bother because acorns are so widely available, and when you mm-hmm. crack them, you get two perfect halves.
Yeah.
Instead of the bitternut, it's kind of, you know, it's all crenulated inside the shell there.
Nice. I wonder if we get the either the two hickories down here in Colorado. I don't know. I'm not as familiar with the terrain here, so. We did. So Corey has a note in here about foraging for invasives. I'm guessing invasive plants. Do you do any of that? Or are you involved in that aspect?
Absolutely. I would say that the vast majority, I would struggle to find a forager that I know that does not harvest invasives, because invasives are, they are so widely available, and mm-hmm. I mean, they're so widely available, and you can harvest as much of them as you would ever want, and you would never make a dent in their population. I mean, common nettles, these are an invasive species. Watercress, we actually need to remove watercress from our pond here at my girlfriend's farm. We have a pond, and everyone's always like, oh, it's so much watercress, it's great. It's like, absolutely. And I eat pounds and pounds and pounds and pounds of it whenever I can. But if we let it get to a certain point, it's also going to crowd out the cutleaf water parsnip, which is actually a native species, and that's not good, you know?
Yep.
So I harvest native plants. I harvest plenty of invasive non-native plants. It kind of just depends on what part of the season is that I'm in. In summer, I would say, when I hunt things around gardens, because gardens, when you disturb any land, it's really good for seed germination, and that's where you're going to see a lot of wild edibles, is just around your garden. And most of those, the vast majority, are going to be non-native invasive plants.
What do you think that is? Is just because the first to come in?
They're so well adapted mm-hmm. to being here. They haven't found like a plant that can outcompete them yet. Like Galansoga parviflora is, or guascas as it's called in Latin America, part of the national dish of Colombia, is a crazy invasive, insanely aggressive plant. It'll kill everything.
So those are things. Do you have some of those topics listed out in your book, as far as identifying any invasives?
My book isn't like an ID. It's not like a field guide, because I could never write anything that would be as good as what Sam Thayer writes. So it's more of like a culinary companion. So I mention them. I don't differentiate between things that are native or non-native in the United States, because my book is released in Britain, in Eastern Europe, in America. So I speak to a very broad audience. So what's invasive for me may not necessarily be invasive for them. So I just kind of cover plants that are really good to eat, that are typically wild.
I can appreciate that. For sure. So someone like me getting into it, foraging for mushrooms can be kind of intimidating when you start talking about like misidentification. What are some tips and resources? You mentioned your mentor, who has some great resources on his website, which I was actually just looking at, but where's a good place for people to start if they want to get into it?
Yeah, I mean, people think mushrooms are dangerous, and, you know, technically eating a burger and getting E. coli is too, or handling a rabbit wrong and getting tularemia is too. That we have like a kind of fungophobic society that Western society kind of has, that you don't see in many, many other countries around the world. it is, identifying mushrooms is a learned skill like anything else. There's so many resources, though. One of the best resources is if you're on Facebook, just look for mushroom group the state that I live in and type that into Facebook and look for a group. And I have one friend here in Minnesota who is an administrator for over 300 mushroom identification groups around the world on Facebook. Wow. 300. Yeah. So there's a ton of mushroom groups, and I guarantee you there is a mushroom group on Facebook or a foraging group on Facebook that is specialized to your state, if not your state, then to a specific part of your state, as there are in Minnesota. Like, we have like 15 different groups for foraging and mushrooms, or foraging and mushrooms combined or separated in Minnesota alone. So the groups are out there, and you know, you don't have to post anything, but seeing what people are picking will show you, this is where I live, this is what people are picking, this is what people are valuing, this is what I should be looking for, and it doesn't cost you anything, and it's like having eyes in the field for you. Field guides are really good, but it is a big leap of faith to look at something on a page and then say, okay, I think this is it. I'm going to put this inside my body. That's a leap of faith, and it can help to have like real live people or experts that can say, hey, this is exactly what you think it is, and you can eat it. And you know, they're not going to like take credit if you poison yourself or something. You know, you need to be sure of what you're doing. But that there, it's a multi-step process. Identification is like, I don't just use one tool. I have expert friends that I contact. I have friends on Facebook that I might ask. I have friends around the world that will harvest mushrooms that I might ask. So you want to ask, you know, you want to ask different resources that you have. Consult the field guide. Consult the Facebook group, or a specialized Facebook group that is not only for your region. Like, there's Chanterelles Across America. That's a group on Facebook specifically for only chanterelles. You know, I think we probably have like 13 different species here. I think I've eaten about 8. You know, and that's just in North America. So it's just, this, you can go as deep as you want to go. But going out with someone in the field is the best way to learn. That being said, it's a lot easier than plants, than mushrooms, because mushrooms don't always come up. But your local mycological society is also another good resource. And Michael Kuo's 100 Edible Mushrooms is a great guide. That one's got a lot of pictures, and it's a little bit smaller. What people will say is like the Bible is David Arora, Mushrooms Demystified is also another good book.
Those are two good, okay, good resources. I did, when I got out to Colorado, I joined it was the Colorado Mycological Society's Facebook group, and then since then I found like 4 other Facebook groups, and I think the coolest thing that stands out to me most around here is, you know, we have a lot of varying elevation in Colorado, and so people will post what they harvested and as well as the elevation they're at, because people are still harvesting morel mushrooms here at various elevations, whereas in other parts of the country they're not. So
yeah, that blows my mind.
Yeah. It was so cool. I was seeing people, and I was like, wait a minute. Like, we're in August. Like, they're like, yeah, you know, I'm at, 9,000 feet. And I'm like, oh, well, I guess that kind of makes sense. So, but no, that's cool. I do want to touch on, this is such an awesome conversation. I'm learning a lot. But I want to touch on a couple of the recipes. And I think it would be appropriate, maybe Corey, for this first one. This is kind of what led you to reach out to Alan, if I'm not correct. So do you want to kind of talk about this one?
Yeah, well, shout out to Evie at Outdoor News for putting me in contact with Alan, because this, I was on Taste of the Wild on Outdoor News, and I saw this, what is it, sesame baked chicken of the woods mushrooms that Alan created. And I was like, I need to talk to that guy. So Evie put me in touch with you, and here we are. So run down this recipe, the inspiration, the recipe development.
Yeah, so it's based on my family's favorite way to cook chicken. Like whenever I had a birthday or whenever we had like a special occasion, my mom would make my grandma's recipe for sesame baked chicken. So I basically took the same kind of idea and then just manipulated a little bit to make it work with mushrooms. And as far as the development and changing things, I didn't have to change too much. I put a little bit of egg. Typically, you just soak the chicken in, like, evaporated milk. I use sour cream, or you could use yogurt, and I whisk an egg yolk into it just to help it tighten a little bit, just to give it a little bit of protein that will coagulate and kind of help it form a crust. And I take a piece of chicken of the woods and dip it in that, and then you roll it in a coating of breadcrumbs and sesame seeds. And oh, there's a nice good pinch of dried wild onion leaves. We have lots of ramps here, but people can just leave that out. And then you drizzle it with melted butter, and you bake that sucker until it's golden brown and delicious. And that's all she wrote.
And I like it. How does – so when you look at the texture of the chicken of the woods, how does the baking change the texture, if at all?
I mean, it just – softens it like it would cooking another mushroom.
Nice. Okay. I've never had it, so I was just curious.
Yeah, the texture is, it's similar to chicken kind. It's similar to chicken. If it tasted like mushrooms.
I don't forage for mushrooms, but I feel like chicken of the woods is one of those more popular, easily identifiable mushrooms that if you're going to start, that's a good one to start with. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I would say that of the hunters that I know, I would say they know morels. And then a few of them will also know chicken of the woods. I don't see them harvesting other ones. I mean, maybe one or two hunters, I don't know, harvest the hen of the woods. And this is only in Minnesota, kind of, you know, with like old timers that I know. But a couple of them do know chickens. So I think they do get a little bit of play. Not as much as morels here in the Midwest, obviously. But they're a great mushroom. They're easy to identify. You know, anything, many things growing on a tree that are big like that, the big polyporous, chicken of the woods, hen of the woods, Echinoderma, black staining polypore, Berkeley's polypore, relatively simple to identify. Chicken of the woods especially, though.
I was looking, and we'll kind of loop this back around now since we're on the topic of hunting and stuff, but the Sochan with the potatoes and venison bacon, like, man, that looks phenomenal. Such a great-looking dish.
Yeah, that was a woman left a comment that she called her family called Sochan bottom greens. And I thought it was a really cool, I knew exactly why she called them bottom greens, why her family did. She didn't say in her comment, but I know why they call them that. So Sochan is a plant that loves river bottoms. Like that's when I go to the river bottoms, I will see as Sochan as far as an eye can see. And she said, we boil potatoes, you boil some Sochan, and then you fry them up, and then you eat them. I was like, that sounds really good. And I think it'd be really good if I put some venison bacon in it. And it is. So that's the dish. It's a super homey, like rustic dish, because I'll put venison bacon in just about anything. That's one of my favorite things to make off a deer.
And the Sochan is one of those that you say comes back up in the fall, and you can get the basil leaves.
Yeah, and it's not even going to come back up in the fall because the flower stalk is still going to be there looking at you, but it's going to have this rebirth like at the base of the plant. You're going to see like, oh, the plant looks dead. Why are there all these flush, giant green leaves at the bottom? So yeah, they're like the best, my favorite leaves of the whole year. You can get like four different harvests of greens off the plant in a season.
Wow, yeah. That's pretty cool. And I like the history too with the Cherokee as well. So,
and it's still sold in farmers markets in the American South.
Huh. I've never come across it.
Yeah. I don't think ever. Each of those four stages, the plant will taste different.
Wow.
Slightly. Varying in intensity as it prepares to flower.
So if you could put it to words in the late summer fall period, as the temps cool and those leaves start to emerge at the bottom of the plant there, what flavor would you be expecting?
It's like eating collard greens that taste like they were crossed with celery.
Oh man, I'm sold.
And then you cook, and then cooking it in lard. They say cook it in lard. Typically now it would be pork, but before pork, they were cooking that in bear fat. I mean, no doubt about that.
Oh, that sounds phenomenal. I've got some bear fat. I know what's going to happen if I can get my hands on some. Okay. Let's see. I think we got time for one more recipe. Let me look at it here. It's the huazantles that we have listed. The milkweed bud huazantles. Am I saying it right?
Yeah.
Perfect. Beautiful dish. Beautiful, beautiful. I love all the sauces, and the presentation is just phenomenal on that one.
Yeah, so what this is, it's really a study in wild foods of Latin America. Huazantle, it means multiple things. And I'm writing a keynote speech to give to a few festivals that I'm talking at this year about this kind of, it's a phenomenon of which huazantles are one of the most perfect examples that I know of. It's a culinary phenomenon around the world, so it's kind of like a human constant. It's something that we're going to see spontaneously generate in our culinary lexicon, for lack of a better word, like our culinary vocabulary of a culture. You're going to have, when there's something that people really, really like, you're going to have one noun that can mean multiple things. Mm-hmm. So huazantle, the name refers to a type of lamb's quarters, and then it refers to that lamb's quarters, like the leaf that you would eat, like wild spinach is one of the names we might use in America. But then it also, huazantle, the same name, also refers to these giant, like, broccoli on a stick, unripe seeds that grow from the top. And they're, like, as long as your arm. These, like, broccoli on a stick.
Oh, wow.
So that's huazantle, too. And then when you make one of the dishes out of the plant, that's also called huazantle. So there's all kinds of, I call it a polynoun. Mm-hmm. A noun that means multiple different things. But you have different examples like this all across the world. But with the milkweed buds, I don't have huazantles here. But unripe milkweed flowers have these like little green balls. They're like tight like a little broccoli. And they're a perfect substitute. So I just cook them like they would the unopened green huazantle flowers in Mexico. And I blanch them, and then I steam all the water out of these. They look kind of like big fat broccoli buds. And you chop them all up, and then I mix them with a little bit of egg, and I put a nugget of cheese in the inside, and then you make them into a little dumpling, and then you dip them in like chili relleno batter, so like whipped egg that you whip till it gets fluffy, and you fry them, and then you simmer them in guajillo chili sauce, and you give them a dollop of sour cream, and there's a couple cilantro flowers on there. But it's basically a cheese-stuffed dumpling made out of weeds.
That's so cool. I like in the article that you have where you lay out the recipe, you have like the step-by-step pictures, and it just looks super cool.
Yeah, that was a really fun one. And you can do it with like all kinds of different plants. I have a similar recipe in the book where I make meatballs out of nettles or greens or whatever greens you have, and I put a big nugget of goat cheese in the middle, and you roll them up, and then you fry them, or saute them, rather, and they're wicked good. A little bit of tomato sauce or whatever.
Oh, that's awesome. So I will ask, I mentioned earlier, I think, on Amazon, but are there other ways people can get your book? And then what are the best ways of people to connect with you if they have like questions, comments, want to share some stories, anything like that?
Yeah, so the book is on Amazon, and I don't really make, no one makes money on books unless you self-publish. So it doesn't matter where you get it. Amazon's fine, or ordering it from Forager's Harvest, which is Sam's, my mentor, Sam's website. You can order it from them too, and that's a good thing to do. A lot of people like to do that. If you do order on Amazon, I appreciate a review. If you enjoy the book, I think there's like 47 of there. We're all five star, so nice. we're doing all right. I'm on Facebook and Instagram. Instagram is probably the easiest, and I'm there, but I'm there answering questions on all the platforms and on the website. You know, I moderate a couple hundred comments a week, so I'm pretty accessible, and I try to answer just about every question that I can, if as long as I can make out something and the picture is not too blurry.
Perfect. That's an awesome way for people to connect to you. I'm going to go on to Sam's website right now and order, pick up your book. So, perfect. Excited for that. Well, this is kind of the point in the show where we give everybody the opportunity to do a last thought, an alibi, last comment, anything you want to leave us or the listeners with or ask. This would be the, if you have anything to share with us, please do.
Well, I would say that plants and mushrooms, you know, they don't get as much respect as a giant rack, but when those times come when you're making tag soup, you'd be appreciative of knowing a few plants or a couple mushrooms. It makes it so you never go home empty-handed.
I like it. I like that. Never go home empty-handed. It's good stuff. All right, Corey, last thought?
I just want to thank Alan for coming on. You have a wealth of knowledge down to the Latin names and everything. So it's been great talking with you. I've learned a lot on this episode. So I am definitely going to do more research on what I have in my area that I can bring home and eat. So nice. Thank you.
And I'll say this, thanks again for coming on, and I've taken away a lot from this episode as well, and I'm excited to kind of grow in that and put some of this knowledge to action. So I would encourage everybody, just as if you listen to our episode probably like 3 or 4 back, where we talk about the misconceptions with trash fish and all the other things, and I think Colin captured a quote of mine where I said that everybody should get out there and explore your rivers and ponds and lakes and oceans around you, and kind of get an understanding of what's there and how you can eat it and how you can work it into your local diet. I would say the same for mushrooms and plants and any wild edibles. Like, I think if you're a person who wants to grow and appreciate food coming from your local area and the outdoors, that this is an excellent avenue. And just like Alan said, that way you're not going home empty-handed, which is cool, because sometimes days aren't as productive as we would like. Yeah, so it's better to come home with with something than nothing. So that's always good. But after you go over and check out Alan's Instagram page, Forager Chef, there, and take a peek at his new book, make sure that you're following us over at Harvesting Nature. And as always, all these awesome links and recipes and everything that we talked about in this episode will be linked in the show notes. And then whatever podcast platform you're listening to, punch that 5-star button and leave us a review. Tell us what we're doing wrong, or, you know, tell us what we're doing right. And I would say this. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.